Soon enough, the Supreme Court of India will pronounce its verdict on what might be called the Muslim hijab issue. It cannot be more than a couple of weeks away, as Justice Hemant Gupta, the senior judge on the bench, retires on 16 October. We cannot speculate on what the verdict will be. We must never speculate. I shall, however, argue that whatever it is, the petitioners will be the losers, unfortunately for them. How can it be? You might ask. If the court rejects their petitions, there are several of them, it will be a legal defeat. It is understandable. But what if the courts rule in their favor? How do they lose then? The answer is that they will lose because even if they succeed in getting the top court to put its approval, its stamp of approval on what is most certainly a conservative practice. By the way, we cautiously avoid the word regressive because that is judgmental. Conservative, on the other hand, is a statement of fact. So even if it's a choice that the courts uphold, even if they don't say it's an essential religious practice, even if they say it's a choice, it will be a socially conservative choice. And indeed, if the court appends the Karnataka High Court order and pronounces that it is an essential religious practice, it will be a double defeat. At home, that is in India, it might leave many Muslim women with no choice as families weigh in. Instead of widening choice, it will end up curtailing it. If an order like that comes, it would even be a godsend for Ayatollahs in Iran. See, even the top court in a secular liberal republic is saying that hijab is an essential religious practice at any age. How can anybody object to this being so in our Islamic republic? A revolutionary one at that. It is purely and wastefully rhetorical to say, how can there be so much emotion among the many modern and wise people in India in favor of the choice to wear the hijab when women in Iran are risking and often sacrificing to fight to free themselves from it? That argument for the hijab skeptics in India is self-serving and defeats itself because the women in Iran are fighting for the choice not to wear the hijab if they so wish. They have no issue with those who are happy to use the hijab doing so. In India, the tussle is very limited, on the other hand. It isn't even about the choice of whether a Muslim woman can or should wear the hijab or not. For sure, anybody who so wishes, who wishes to wear the hijab can. Our current debate and the issue in the Supreme Court is limited to this being a right also for school-going non-adults. I repeat, school-going non-adults. The Karnataka issue is about young women all in their teens going to senior school wearing the hijab above their uniforms, school uniforms. It is likely that the issue has been distorted in the public mind because the institutions involved were called college. But these are junior colleges in Karnataka, as they are called in Karnataka. They would be called senior schools in other places. So these are junior colleges or senior schools teaching students in class 11 and 12. By implication, only a rare student there would be adult yet, if at all. In India, we pass class 12 normally by age 17. That should help us finesse this issue. There is no such thing as a non-polarized time in a democracy. But at this juncture, we are more polarized than ever in our history. This is a clinically factual statement because what else can we conclude from a situation where one party has won two successive majorities almost entirely on the strength of one faith's votes? So BJP has won two successive majorities almost entirely on the strength of the Hindu vote. In the two successive elections of 2014 and 19, BJP has had 586 candidates elected and not one out of them was a Muslim. A polarized electorate produces a government of one side. It is natural then that it brings insecurities and discomfort for those left out. The cornered minorities tend to lean back and protect the roots and fundamentals of what is so dear to them. Politically, it can often be a bad trap. To unravel this complexity, we travel back 37 years to the Shah Bano case. It was a simple enough case of a 73-year-old divorcee going to court seeking an alimony. A personal case becomes a religio-political or politico-religious cause célèbre as the Muslim clergy saw it as a challenge to their personal law, which does not provide for any alimony except for what is committed mehr at the time of nikah. Obviously, some Hindu groups also saw it as an opportunity to fight for justice for a Muslim woman. And you know how it goes in polarized systems, that each faith or each section wants to fight for the freedoms of women of the other side. The case reached the Supreme Court, where the bench, headed by who else but then Chief Justice Y.V. Chandrachud, the father of the next CJ-to-be now, ruled in favor of the Indore woman, divorced after 43 years of marriage. She was awarded an alimony of, hold your breath, a mere 500 rupees a month. But it was seen as an assault on the Muslim way of life, Muslim personal law. Many Muslim mobs burned the effigies of Chandrachud, Senior Chandrachud, obviously. I reported it then and wrote a cover story for India Today magazine then. You can see the screenshots on my screen. I'm also sharing a link to the full story from India Today's archives. This was 1985, and among people I went to speak to was Maulana Abdul Lais, the Amir of Jamaat-e-Islami Hind. Check out that story in the link that I'm sharing with you. He is quoted in that story as saying that Indian Muslims' fight wasn't so much about their lives and property right now. It wasn't about livelihoods and property. It was about their culture and identity. Ibn Sayyid Shahabuddin, with top education, a former diplomat, brilliant intellectual, weighed in with the conservative side. He challenged the judgment intellectually and politically by contesting the Kishanganj by-election in Bihar, which Rajiv Gandhi's Congress had won by 1.3 lakhs votes just a year earlier. He won it mainly because he used the Shah Bano case as an election plank. I went to speak with him as well, and he, as usual, spoke with clarity. This, he said, was a fight against the inexorable process of assimilation. His words, not mine. And how was he fighting it? By destroying the Congress party's Muslim vote bank. And I quote him now, this Muslim vote bank has come crashing down, and all the king's horses and all the king's men cannot put it back there again. Shahabuddin was right in that the Congress Muslim vote bank has never been put back again post Shah Bano. It also angered the Hindus and fueled the BJP campaign of minority appeasement. The many further blunders Rajiv Gandhi made in trying to assuage the Hindus now, including the unlocking of the Babri Ayodhya site, which Jairam Ramesh recently acknowledged as an error, this angered the Muslim community even more and failed to convince the Hindu majority as well. So Muslim minority was lost and the Hindu majority was lost as well. The political result finally is the two successive majorities for Narendra Modi's BJP. Remember again, it was all about a rupees 500 a month alimony for a 73-year-old, mostly illiterate and poor divorcee. What's happening right now is about a few school kids seeking the right to wear the hijab over their school uniforms. It isn't as if there weren't voices of modernity then. There were many within the Muslim community. Arif Muhammad Khan, then a minister of state in Rajiv's Council of Ministers, argued for not interfering with the SC judgment. He said, and I quote, "My faith, Islam, is progressive and modernizing." This was an interview in the same story in India Today magazine. Ultimately, he had to resign as an angry man from the Congress party and the government. Quoted in the same 1985 story is Shahid Siddiqui, then young editor of Urdu Daily, Nayi Dunya, and now one among the five Muslim notables who met to have that conversation with Mohan Bhagwat. Every small town, and I'm quoting now, quote, "Every small town Maulana has become a leader now with narrow objectives and narrow interests," then Shahid Siddiqui had said. There was also Professor Kausar Azam, who taught political science at Hyderabad's Osmania University. She ruled the absence of reformers like Mahatma Gandhi and Raja Ram Mohan Rao among the Muslims, and the sad fact that a modernizer like Hamid Dalwai died so young. Another liberal modern voice that featured in that story is that of JNU professor Zoya Hassan. The liberal modern voices then were all overlooked, and there were political consequences. Consequences so serious that almost four decades later, we are caught in a very similar tussle over the hijab issue. The issue of choice here is also a code for protecting culture, identity, and pushing back inexorable assimilation and so on. The big difference is that the educated, respectable, and established Muslim voices that were on the modernizing side on the Shahbano issue are on the other side now. They fought a good moral and intellectual battle in 1985 and then lost. They are fighting on the opposite side now, mostly because they worry about Narendra Modi, and those worries are justified. Unfortunately for them, however, they are set to lose again, whatever the verdict, as we had argued early on.